Struggling to move your nonprofit forward? You've come to the right place. Welcome to the Nonprofit Architect, where we are giving you the actionable steps you need to launch and grow your nonprofit organization. Now, here's your host, Travis Johnson.
Hey, welcome back to the show. I'm here today with Dean Crown. Dean, how are you doing today?
Hey, Travis, doing really, really good. Thanks.
Excited to have you on. You are the benefit auctioneer specialist and the author of Paddles Up. And I just so happen to have a copy right here for the viewers watching this thing. Those of you listening on audio, I'm holding up a book and you should be watching the video anyway. You can grab your free copy, paddlesupbook.com. Dean, how long have you been in the auctioneer game?
2008. So what is that?
14 years for public math.
14 years.
Yeah.
So professionally, let's call it 12 years. Because for the first 2 years, I was flying pro bono and didn't realize it was a job. I did it pro bono and volunteered for fun because I was an actor. When I didn't have a paid job, I would do that. And I didn't, auction for little fundraisers. I had no idea that you needed a skill. I made it up.
You made it up. You just, we're just going to wing this thing. It's going to be great.
Yeah. There were none of those shows yet, right? So none of the Storage Wars, any of that. I guessed on what I needed to be doing. It was probably the dumbest thing these little nonprofits ever did because they didn't book me. I was free, right? So, but to say, hey, bring on the free guy who didn't know what he was doing. But the entertainment factor for them was at a 10. The fundraising was probably at a 2.
Fundraising at a 2. Entertainment, watching you stumble all over everything you're doing is at a 10.
But you know what? They loved it. They were like, oh my God, that's the most fun we've had in a long time. And I live in Atlanta. So the state of Georgia, where you do have to be licensed and you have to check some states you have to be, some you don't. The state of Georgia said, hey, because people started calling and then I started charging a nominal fee. And they said, hey, you know, you have to have a license here. And that's when I really got clued in because I went to 10 days nonstop. And this was over an Easter weekend of auctioneer school. 99.9% of it is all legal logistics contracts that has nothing to do with me and my type of auctioning. I don't handle money. This is for all the auctioneers to do, but I learned a ton. And then you have to take your test with the state of Georgia, which I keep up every year, and my license. And you have to have an escrow account. I've had an escrow account for 11 years. That I've never touched because the state of Georgia needs access to it in case you're ripping somebody off. And again, I don't touch money. There's a lot of barriers. Tennessee's the worst. Tennessee, I think you have, or the best, if you look at it this way.
You've heard it here first. Tennessee is the worst.
I mean the best because you have to be an apprentice, I believe, for 2 years before you can become an auctioneer. So actually the barrier, the vetting, you know, down in the South is it's a lot. And so I like in New York and California, I don't think you have to be licensed, but it caused me to join the Auctioneers Association and it caused me to go through their benefit auctioneer specialist designation. And I was the first in Georgia to get it. It's a designation. It's a real deal. I got a real lay. It's on the back of the book. I think I learned more about the craft of selling and helping nonprofits because of that. And I got to tell you, it changed my whole career and my whole life because I didn't think I had a career in this. Now I do.
What was the difference between winging it with fun factor 10 to doing it professionally? Did the fun factor go down?
The fun factor changed. It's still fun. There became a logic and a true goal and a skill now that I had. The seriousness became a 10 because what I'd learned is these nonprofits are on the front line. They're underpaid. They're overworked. They are out there helping their client. And I got to tell you, when I realized I've got the cushy job, I'm wearing the tux. I'm not sweating it like they are every day. So the seriousness became, I need to get as much money for my nonprofit so they can keep the fight up and get, they're on the front line so they can keep that fight up. that never leaves my mind. They are the true hero, and the people they're helping are the hero. I'm not the hero. I'm not the star. I'm just the goofball up on stage. But that's why I keep learning and learning and learning. How can I, what ideas can I bring to the table that will make their lives easier?
Oh, I like that. I like that.
Yeah, that was the big change.
Yeah. Really taking that ownership, that responsibility. You understand your part in the series and the work and the evolution of everything that a nonprofit needs. So that's really good. I like that. You mentioned that you were kind of the entertainment because you were bumbling around. I don't know about everyone else. I know some of those shows out there where you're kind of just waiting for the disaster to happen every episode, like Frasier. Like, there's always a part where it's just a mess. That is my least favorite part. I can never watch that part of the show because you just see the train wreck coming the whole time. And you know what happens. And when it happens and it inevitably blows up every episode, that's when I go refresh my beverage or whatever. But there's so many people that just love that part of it. They're like, oh, I hate drama if it's mine. But if it's somebody else's, like, give me a front row seat. I never understood that.
See, I like watching the train wreck. Like, Frasier is one of my favorite shows. I love the train wreck. I used to do murder mysteries. I used to do every kind of corporate entertainment. Did a little bit of film, a little bit of TV, lots and lots of commercials. I was a hand model. I was an Elvis impersonator. I was the Forrest Gump impersonator. You name it, I did it. Anything not to work a real job. And I was eking out a nice, a medium-sized little living here in Atlanta before the big film boom now. And anything to stay alive. Thank God I had my wife working at Home Depot who had a real career. She really kept us going. All those years of doing that, because I'm probably in my 30th year of entertainment, those chops taught me how to be on stage, how to be appropriate on stage. So winging it still had a set of rules. It's just I didn't understand the skill of selling and asking for money for a nonprofit, right? That's the part I had to learn, which in turn upped my entertainment game. Because of that skill, I had to learn how to entertain a little differently and meld them.
Yeah.
God, it's been a great lesson. And going home at night, instead of making it's all about me, mm-hmm. going home at night, and my wife worked in nonprofit forever after Home Depot, and going home and going, she'll ask, how much did you raise for him tonight? Man, that's a normal conversation in our house. How much did you raise? How much did we... what changed? Or, oh man, the crowd was crying because we heard this testimonial, or I didn't know this about this disease. It's really kind of changed our relationship too for the better, which has always been really, really tight. But I don't know, it's all the way around just feels good to do what I do.
Yeah, it's easier to support someone when the focus isn't on what you're doing. It's what you're doing on behalf of or for another organization. That's why people love police, fire, EMS, military so much, because they're not doing it for themselves, the vast majority of them. They're doing it for other people. Same thing with the nonprofit work. You're doing it for someone else. Yeah, is there some feel good? Of course there is, but really you're doing it on behalf of somebody else, which is wonderful. Today we're going to break down and get into your book, and we're going to talk about things like the fund to need method, what that framework looks like. We're going to talk a little bit about live auctions, silent auctions. The coolest thing I want to talk about is the golden ticket, but we're going to get to that in a little bit. What is the fund to need framework? What is that?
So the fund to need has many names, the paddle raise, the mission moment. I'm all about branding it, by the way. Call it yours, meaning put an action verb in there, whatever you do. Like I have a music, what do you call it? A symphony. And they called it share the music, you know, something that works for you. But it is now the fund to need, and that's just the term I use. The fund to need is the biggest money maker outside of sponsorships at an event. And it was invented probably 15 years ago by, I think the gentleman's name was Jay, and I didn't know him very well. I met him once or twice, but he kind of invented this concept. It has just caught on. It's where donors can give any amount of donation that they want, from $1 to $1 million. It's the very organized way of giving at a gala. And it is, you don't have to buy anything or go get items to sell. You don't have to do any of that. It's based on emotion, a testimonial video, from the nonprofit, from a, you know, somebody that they serve. And it's, ladies and gentlemen, we need to raise $50,000 in 5 minutes. And we call out different levels, starting high, going low. Mm-hmm. Who will give 5,000? And we give information about what that 5,000 could do. And we collect and move to the next level. So it is, I become a specialist in it, and I love it because I see people band together and literally make dreams come true by reaching these goals for the nonprofit.
Mm-hmm. Do you find in your experience that it's easier to get the donations if you can say, hey, your $1,000 equals this output, or if it's more ambiguous? Which one of those works better?
You know what? They both work. So let's call it 80% of my nonprofits, when we're building this, because I consult with my clients the minute they book me, usually a year in advance. I'm a consultant. That's first and foremost what I do, really. And then the rest is on stage. So when we're building the levels and talking about it, if they can connect with what it does. So I do, I have horse therapy. Well, that's easy. You know, $1,000 will buy X amount of hay, or a vet's visit for 6 horses or something like that. So that's really easy to build. And you're right, in a donor's mind or a giver's mind, they can connect that. And we don't earmark the money. We're saying, here's what it could do. And maybe we give them a couple examples. However, when I'm doing medical, like muscular dystrophy or LLS, it's research. So it's kind of hard to put a dollar value on that research. If we have done the emotional connection correctly, that's the testimonial and explaining why it's so important. I don't think connecting the dollar with what it could do is as important. So in both cases, especially in the last 2 years with virtual and COVID, I've seen it all rise, all the funding need rise. So yes, if you can connect it, great. But I don't think one trumps the other.
That's interesting to hear. How about the type of video they use? I'm a huge fan of, this is like the triumph video. This is where they were, and this is now what they are amazingly doing. I've seen a lot of those, huge fan of those. Not a huge fan of like the one everyone knows, the Sarah McLachlan sad story of the sick puppies. Like, do you recommend one or the other? Have you seen them use both throughout your auctioneering career of 11 escrow, 12 professionally, 14 casually in your years of service?
Yes. So no, the commercial, like with Sarah there, so that's a whole different thing, right? That's a commercial trying to get you to patron for, you know, once a month, or you know, for a year at least. What works, there's two kind of videos. There's an umbrella video, and this is what I recommend. There are these two videos. An umbrella video. An umbrella video all about what you do in 3 minutes or less. If you make a video over that, we can't use it at the event. It will, people will start to go to the bar. So we want them focused. So, but an umbrella video is great because let's assume half those guests, 3/4 of those guests, they just were brought there by a friend. So they don't know what you do. So they're learning. They learn in 3 minutes or less why they should give, right? So those are really important. If you make a really long video, put it online before they come to the event, tell them to go watch it, and then we're going to play a 3-minute version when they get there, right? So it still works. The other kind of video, which I'm a big, big fan of, is if we have a testimonial, a live testimonial, and let's just say it's a family that overcame something, a disease or, you know, or going through a hardship. It's about a 2 or 3 minute video of a day in the life of about that person and their family. So it doesn't have to be like super heartstring. It's informational, but it's emotional, but you don't have to go the Sarah route because the audience gets it.
Yeah. Yeah. But the video itself, right, the day in the life of, do they show the video and it stops like just as how hard it is? Or do they include the part where the organization came in and now their life is different? Do they stop at just the sad stuff or do they include the change?
I like the change.
Yeah.
I'm all about the change. And if that change wasn't in the video, then it needs to be in the testimonials live speech. But I'm with you. I call it rags to riches. What was your life before this nonprofit got became a partner with you, mm-hmm. and what is it after? So yes, because people, we're still at a gala. We still want to feel good. I got to tell you, I do 80 to 100 of these a year, and I hear a lot of the testimonials. The toughest ones, because I'm a parent, the toughest ones are literally when a parent, I had a couple get up a couple months ago, and they had lost their child to suicide in less than a year prior. And there they are up there giving this testimonial because this nonprofit still helped them. And they're still, the point being that they are still giving a positive, even after all this horrible, horrible thing happened. You know, they're given a positive of please help because our son couldn't be helped, but you're going to be helping a bunch of other families prevent this. So even in the worst case, they're still spinning. What do they say? The silver lining, right? So yeah, I like the rags to riches, really.
It's the transformational stories are the best ones, especially when they showcase what the nonprofit actually does. I know I do a lot of research and have a lot of discussion with nonprofits. Sometimes the conversations are like, what is it that you actually do? Because you can't find anywhere online, at their website, anywhere on social media, what it is they're actually doing. And now if you're in the nonprofit world and you're listening to this right now, don't keep that stuff a secret. Don't hold that back until the gala or the gala to showcase what it is you're doing. Show people every day what on earth it is that you do, what the transformation is. If you've got legal concerns and you can't use their name, don't use their name. Say, hey, we had a single mom come in today and we were able to give them cash directly to meet their need so they could do this, that, and the other. Say that. Don't say Melissa Thompson is 39 living at the, say,
right.
Say who you helped, right? Don't give out their name, but showcase what you're doing for people, because don't make it hard for people to understand what it is that you do and how you're impacting your community.
Well, early on, I had clients who were afraid to promote what they do in a positive manner. They're really changing lives. Like, why wouldn't you get on a, why won't you get on a bandstand and say that? This is important. So here's what I do now. Well, a lot of them have got, no, if you're going to work with me, we're going to promote what you've done. This is education for your donors. And I guarantee you, even the donor that follows you the most doesn't know everything you do, does not know every program that you do, right? So here's what I tell them. There's two points that we can really promote it. At the event, what I call a PowerPoint billboard. It's the rotating slides on the screen during the cocktail hour when they're walking around, talking, you know, hanging out. Somebody's waiting at the bar for their drink and they just look up at the screen and they see, and I say, write 10 to 15 slides of, did you know? Just one fact. Did you know, thanks to your donations, you helped 6,000 families this year not become homeless or whatever it is? I say little sound bites. So do that on the rotating billboard. Then when we get to the fund a need, we're going to pick 6 or 7 very empathetic facts that I will share with the audience. Mm-hmm. And it becomes this great food for thought. And every little of this fact, hopefully register, I need to give more. I was thinking about giving at the $100 level, but you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to give it the $250 level. That's what I hope is working.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I love that. How did COVID change the landscape of the gala? How did it affect the fund to need giving?
Luckily, it didn't. The two shockers were, because I was one of the first to go virtual on the East Coast. So the week everything shut down, like March 13th, I think on the 20th, I think I had to do my first one. And, you know, we didn't know what we're doing. We didn't know if they were going to respond.
High entertainment factor. Didn't know what you're doing.
Oh, yeah. You know, luckily I understood how to talk to a camera and I just assume somebody's on the other side, hopefully smiling and listening. But yeah, when there's only 3 people in a studio and you're not sure if it's landing, that's always fun. But the numbers that started coming out, sponsorships stayed and didn't go away. Sponsorships upped their game. So if you were a sponsor during that part, thank you. Thank you. Thank you to all you out there who help nonprofits. And then the giving didn't change. I have some clients, we made more in the fund to need. And the big reason was because it didn't matter who was in the room because there was no room. It's now worldwide. Mm-hmm. Virtual changed the game. And all of that now I bring to a gala. I tell them, open up your fund to need online a week before the event and keep it open a week after the event, because there are going to be a ton of people who can't come. Let them give. I've got clients, we walk into the room and they made 10 grand that week before. So we can add that to the number at the end. And then I've got clients who kept it open another week and made another 10 grand. So it's now a new best practice.
Oh, I love that. I love to hear that. I'm glad that this stuff worked out. I know that from my experience, all the people that continued to ask in whatever capacity during the pandemic, you know, they lost maybe the 250 or the 500 and below, but they gained $1,000, $5,000, $10,000 donors, because they understand, people with that level of cash understand that the need is greater at those times. And there was a lot of people that I talked to that felt uncomfortable asking. It was like, your need didn't go away. You're feeding people. People are still hungry. Don't stop asking just because you feel awkward. You're feeling awkward. It's going to impact them, because if they're not eating, that is a life or death thing. That's people that could end up dying because they didn't eat today. I am not in that category. I could probably go a couple of days without eating myself. But
yeah, but you and me both. I was shocked, actually. I didn't know people would give, because we were in such a crisis. You know, I assume everybody's just going to guard their money because we didn't know what was going to happen. And not once, Travis, did I see anybody hold back. The numbers kept rising. And then when I started doing live events last August, I did my last virtuals last August, right? So from August to now, it's been nonstop live events. And most of them here in Georgia, even though I travel nationally, and still same thing. At first, let's call it August through the end of that year, last year, doubling the fund to need. Less people in the room because they had to space out, and they only invited the top givers, and they were having smaller events live, making double the money in the fund to need. People wanted to support and they wanted to give. And I tell you, it's been fantastic. People are good. You and I get to see the good in people for the most part.
Well, the good is there in everyone if we look hard enough. Some people make it just a little bit harder to find that gold than others do. But, you know, those prospectors that went out to California during the gold rush, they sifted through tons of dirt, days, weeks, months, sifting tons of dirt just to find a few tiny golden nuggets. So don't give up. Don't give up hope. People are good.
They are. And agreed. And I just happened to get to see 300 to 1,000 of them at a time, those nuggets in one room.
Yeah. Collect your nuggets. Call Dean. He'll come have an event for you.
That's right.
Get your nuggets together. I was reading your book. You talk a little bit about a fireside chat. What is a fireside chat?
Came out of virtual. So that's for the fund to need. So when it used to be, when I would do an event, and this is before we even knew we could virtually go out there and ask for money too, I would have for each level what the level could do, or fact. I'm a big fan of put a fact about the level. Did you know? Here's a negative. Did you know there are at any given time in Atlanta, 10,000 homeless on the street? Let's say I'm working for a homeless shelter, and this is all hypothetical, but your $1,000 can get 100 off the street each night and feed them and house them. So we would do a fact, and then I would ask for people to raise. When we went to virtual, because there was no audience and because we had to be socially distanced, it would usually just be the executive director or the CEO of the nonprofit and myself on camera. And so instead of me just talking straight at the camera and them sitting at their podium doing nothing, I said, well, why don't we have a conversation? And I'll do those same facts, but I'm going to turn it over to you. I'm going to say something like, I understand there are 10,000 homeless right now tonight here in Atlanta, such and such executive director. What will this $1,000 do for you? And then let her or him explain it in 30 seconds or less. Well, when last August, when I switched to go back to live, I just said, well, let's see if it works on stage. And a bunch of clients were willing to do it, and it's been gangbusters. So instead of me just talking at you or to you on here's why you need to give, now it's a, like a conversation, if you will. And it has done so, so well, because I think when you hear from the nonprofit and you got me, the money motivator, working in harmony, it just, again, goes back to more food for thought on why I need to not give $100. I need to give $250, $500, or $1,000. I need to give more than I thought I was going to give.
See, I like that. I like that engagement. I love that personal nature. It seems that there's a lot of events out there where it's just kind of talking at an audience. And if you can get them included, if you can bring them into the conversation, if you can be more conversational, I think that's better for everybody.
Absolutely. In fact, let me say something on that. One of my clients took it several steps further. They have they're a breast cancer rehab, so it's physical therapy. And a lot of people never get to meet the therapist. So they had six of them on stage with me, and each one of them took a level. So I would ask a question and one would step up and answer, and then the next one. So the audience got to meet them at the same time, which upped the giving. So I thought that was a brilliant idea.
Oh, I like that. I'm going to include that in my next one that I do, whatever that is. We'll, we'll figure that one out.
Call me. I'll talk you through it.
In your book, you get into things like live auction, silent auction, a few different things. How do people decide what they should get for a live auction? Like, where do they find the items?
Today, people are starting to give again. Prior to COVID, there were two ways. It was counting on that nonprofit's board, which are the board is usually very helpful because they have access to items like beach houses and travel items and dinners or VIP tickets, sports, concerts, that kind of thing, because these are all the things that sell. And then the other way was consignment companies, which still is, that they're companies who put together exotic packages and travel usually, and they charge the nonprofit a certain price called a reserve price. And then you sell it, and that nonprofit keeps whatever is above the reserve price. So if it sold for 10 grand and the reserve price was 2 grand, the nonprofit keeps the 8 grand, right? So both of those were always working. So when COVID and virtual happened, it was very hard to get things. So we relied on consignment, but nobody was traveling then, right? So now what I'm seeing is a lot of my nonprofits are starting to get all the stuff that they got before, but they're relying on consignment companies where they may not have before COVID for a couple of extra items, like something to use in the golden ticket, something that is big. And I call it bucket list, because everybody who came out of COVID back to these events, they are buying bucket list trips, because I think we took stock in the last couple of years that we could die any minute. I'm going on the bucket list. I'm selling Tuscany right now. I've always sold Tuscany 4 or 5, you know, at an event. I sold 16 the other night and 13 the month before. People want to do their bucket list stuff. So it's kind of interesting to see the changes.
I found that interesting. I was in the Middle East when COVID started, and I had been traveling in 2019, and then COVID stole all my travel plans because I had more set up. Like, my bucket list items, like, I've been to every continent on the Northern Hemisphere, but I have not been to Australia, South America, or Antarctica. So, like, no kidding. I'm reading the book earlier today. It's like bucket list trips. And I'm like, oh, can I take a cruise down to Antarctica? You can. You can fly down to Argentina. You can go to Buenos Aires. And there's another port that I probably can't pronounce correctly. And you get on a cruise ship and you go down to a couple islands and you go down to the Antarctic Peninsula and you can get down and see all the animals. I don't think you play with the penguins, but, you know, for us, we saw penguins in Dubai a couple of years ago. Do these trips, do this stuff, please, dear God. But talking to my dad, who retired just a couple of years ago, he's retired military. I'm retired military. Get on Mac flights, go around. He's on a trip right now. He's got a camper, the highest gas prices in recent memory. He's going through like Yosemite and all up and down the West Coast and going on Highway 1, because what better, there's no better time than now. And people have got to take advantage of that.
Yeah, it doesn't matter about like, so we just got back from Hawaii. Now, normally I'm like, can we afford to go to Hawaii? Well, it changed in March. It was like, what's our bucket list? Well, we can't afford not to go now because we don't know when we're going to have this time again. And I'm so glad we did. We have a 15-year-old, right? His life is changing every day. College is coming up. I was like, let's do it now. And really, gas prices be damned and flights be damned because we're going to do it. We were sensible. But man, I'm so glad we did. And I think that's what's happening with a lot of the buyers. Now, I don't know if that's going to continue, meaning that we've been riding this wave of people finally getting out, things happening in gala world, and they're starting to buy these trips because they know they can go again. If a variant comes up, is that going to slow them down? Are they finally going to go, you know what? I need to hold some money. Maybe I'll do a trip that's national, New York or the beach or something. I don't know. My job is to identify the waves and kind of figure out where we are and tell my client to help them make the decision on the type of things we need to have.
I know I got a friend, Dr. Craig Hansen. He runs the University of New Zealand, and I just got the invite from him because New Zealand is back open again. I don't know this for a fact, but I think New Zealand is the most liberal country on the planet. So they were like hard lockdown. You couldn't leave town. I saw an article where three guys got arrested for like making a jailbreak. They went to KFC in a neighboring town during COVID, God forbid. You decide, you listening at home, decide what that means to you. I just thought it was ridiculous. Some people are like, well, yeah, you can't travel. Wherever you're at on the spectrum, I understand. I still love you. But like arresting people for going to KFC, like KFC is criminal for offering all those calories in such delicious packages. It shouldn't be the people going there that are the criminals, but.
You know, people just wanted to get out and bus free. And, you know, I guess they're doing it now. I'm surprised. Was the Taco Bell not open?
I don't know.
Did they have to go to KFC?
They're available. I got to look into that before I go see my buddy Craig down in New Zealand. I was reading an interesting stat in your book. It says that most silent auction items don't really cover the cost of what they're worth. But there's one item in particular that has a great rate of return, and that's the gift card. Is it the gift card that is that's a great rate of return?
Yeah. Okay. So let me back up on what you said. So correct. The silent auction, which most galas who aren't done by professional in-house development teams, if you're a volunteer doing schools, say, or something like that, the first thing they think of is a silent auction. Well, the silent auction is not the best moneymaker. It's the most work for the least return. National average, 50% fair market value. So if that item's worth $100, you're going to probably get 50. But it took a lot of energy to go out and ask for it, to store it, to display it, to write it up in the mobile bidding site, to ship it if you had to ship it to somebody or, you know, carry it to the event. There's a lot to it, right? This is a shocker, though. During COVID and the virtual events, gift cards were selling at 200-300%. That's shocking. I mean, I'll tell you in the fall, because I'm on most auctioneers, the summer's pretty low. I have maybe three events in the summer. But I'll tell you coming up fall, if we are still riding that wave of gift cards selling well, I think that was more of a virtual, let's support them, let's overpay for this item. So it's yet to be seen where that's going to go.
Yeah, it's interesting you brought up a school fundraiser with silent auction items, because I remember distinctly going to my kid's school and my wife and I trying to get a deal for all this stuff. Like, what would we be willing to pay to still get a good deal on all the stuff we wanted or cared about? How could we still support? That's one side of us. The other side of us is like, don't have my kid sell candy bars for a fundraiser. Like, how many dollars can I give you to not ask my kid to do this? $300? Here you go. We're not selling nothing. Please, dear God. Because the kids don't sell it. We end up selling it. You know what I mean?
But you absolutely said the dichotomy of the two mindsets.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, the third. Yes. Please, I don't want my son having to do that because I'm going to end up being the one who has to do it. The mindset is normally two things. Number one, I want to go support this school. I want them to be a success. I love this school. But when you get there, I think this is just a human thing. How can I get a deal? How can I get that cheap? Right? Because we're used to shopping that way.
Mm-hmm.
I battle that mindset of donors and buyers every night. I want them coming in going, how can I overpay to make this nonprofit or this school or what have you a huge success? I used to do a thing where I would hold up, going back to gift cards. I would go, ladies and gentlemen, I have a $100 gift card, you know, to Home Depot. Who will give me $50 for it? Raise your hand if you'll just give me $50 for it. And like, you know, everybody's hand will go up and I'll keep moving up until I'm at 100. Then a bunch of hands start going down. I'm at value. Then I go, who will give 105? Some hands stay up, 110. So I think the best I ever did is I sold a $20 gift card for $500 once. And I asked the guy later, I said, why did you overpay for that? And he goes, because I had the money I wanted. I already knew what I was going to spend. And I wanted, I'm going to support this organization no matter what. And I thought that would just be fun to do it that way. And he actually, he made a statement, because this was early on in the auction. He made such a statement of, this is why we're here today, folks. So I saw the bids become higher.
Oh, nice. Way to set that high anchor point and bring everyone up. It's interesting because, like, Americans, myself included, I want a deal. If I go to a estate sale, like, I want a deal. I want to find something cool. I want to pay very little for it. When I was in the Middle East, I don't know if it's every country over there, it was a certain group of people, but they prefer and they say and shout it from the rooftops that they paid full price for something. That's their thing. A lot of the guys in the shops and the market or whatever, they'll haggle with you. That's kind of the running game. But the people that have money that never go to those places, they want to say, look at this. Isn't it beautiful? Paid full price, paid top dollar. They want it to showcase that of how wealthy they are. And that is the method that they do that.
Well, my wife hates to haggle, right? I love it. Yeah. I don't mind doing it because I do it for a living. But I will see, you know, a lot of people ask me, do you see a lot of egos in the room? Do you see a lot of people giving to be seen? I got to say, it's a smaller amount. There, a lot of people will remain anonymous. They're not trying to be showy. I think because they're putting the nonprofit first.
Yeah, yeah.
And which I love. I just love that. I don't mind showy. I do a thing where at the beginning of the fund to need, I'll tell you the goal. Ladies and gentlemen, we need to raise $25,000 in 5 minutes. Hey, before I start the first level of 5,000 or whatever we determined, hey, you know, I make a joke. I go, will somebody just give us the 25,000 so I can move on? There's a laugh. I would say about a dozen times in my career, somebody stood up and said, I'll give it to you. And that was real. It wasn't fake. I think the highest I had somebody give 75 grand or 50 grand, something like that. That was our goal. But then I go on and collect now from the rest of the audience. And I got to tell you, they don't have a name. They're not making a big deal. They don't say where they're from or who they are. They just show me their bidder number. And I got to tell you, that is some of the greatest stuff I ever see. I'm just lucky to see these people. And my client, by the way, had no idea this person existed. Now we got a new patron. So now they have a new supporter they can talk to.
That is super cool. I talked to a gal doing events in London, and she does it differently. She finds out of people that are invited that have bought the tickets that, you know, has spent the most. She finds out who the competitors are, direct competitors, and puts them at a table. And they've got iPads at the table. And when they see their competitor reach over to bid, they'll wait till they look away and then they'll grab it. Then they'll outbid them on something just to keep that rivalry going and growing.
Oh, I had a Chick-fil-A, which is a restaurant over on this side. Do you have Chick-fil-A over there?
Chick-fil-A is everywhere. I had Chick-fil-A in the Middle East. Yeah.
Oh, good, good, good. So Chick-fil-A is based in Atlanta, right? So Chick-fil-A has a great college bowl here in Atlanta. I think they do it in December. And Chick-fil-A had given VIP seats to this bowl, and you get to bring the game ball in the car on the field, the game ball to the refs. I mean, this is big. You get to go all the VIP stuff and all that, right? So I'm selling it. And I only had one to sell. And I the bidding is back and forth between these two guys, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And then I sold it to the one guy. Well, the representative from Chick-fil-A looked at me because it went so high. And he looked at me and he said, do this, which means go ahead and sell a second set. And which was great because now we're going to double it because this is a donation from them. So let's just say I sold it at 20 grand. So I turned to the backup guy who was maybe what, $500 away, $250 away from the winning bid. And I said, sir, they have given two. Now you will have your two seats next to our winner. You will do the ball with him. Da, 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 da. Do you want it? And he was shaking no. And he was very hesitant, or not no yet, but hesitant. To the point where the crowd is going, well, and they're all shouting. And he finally said, yes. Well, at the end of the event, I went up to him and I said, thank you so much. And he goes, I'm sorry, I was hesitant. And I go, what are you talking about? He goes, the guy who won is my chief rival and we can't stand each other. And now we have to sit next to each other at this event because they were trying to outbid each other. And I'd never seen that. And I said, well, you change lives, dude. I mean, quite honestly, you know, send somebody in your place, but, or maybe you'll become friends. Who knows?
Have Chick-fil-A sponsor a divider to put in the seats between them.
That's right. Of chicken.
A chicken wall. Jesus, chicken wall.
That's right.
There you go.
But again, the good came out of this. The guy knew why he was there. It may be his intentions at first, but he really made the difference. It made the event.
I'm working on trying to let positive feedback fuel me. I grew up on negative feedback. Someone tells me I can't do something, I'm like, watch me. So now when I get good feedback, I'm like, yeah, whatever. Someone's like, you can't do this, Travis. You'll never be a success. I'm like, oh, here we go. Let's go. So I can understand that rivalry stuff. I can understand the back and forth. Working on getting on the positivity train. It doesn't always work for me, but yeah, you know.
But you're trying. It's a tough. Yeah, I'm the same way.
Yeah. Tell me I'm terrible, please. Please.
Well, sometimes you'll say, you can't do that. And I'll go, yeah, you're right. And I won't do it because I probably didn't really want to do it.
Yeah.
But when I when they told me I couldn't be an actor, or they told me, you know, I'm not going to be much, man, like I was a class clown, believe it or not. And they're going to be like, you will never find a job where you can be a class clown. Well, technically I have now. And I do well. I'm a class clown with a focus, right? And and I'm here. I've got an agenda for my client. But I like a good challenge. You know, trying to teach my son that too. Like with baseball, when he feels he can't do something, he will work harder at it. And I'm just thrilled. I don't know where he learned that. Hopefully from his parents, but I'm proud of him that he's doing it.
That is really good. There's so many people that could use a little bit of extra drive, could use a little bit of extra dig deep and go for it. I mean, I remember made a comment about Kobe Bryant the day that he passed, and I didn't really know anything about him or who he was. And there's an aviation guy, aviation safety guy. So I made a comment about aviation safety and someone's like, you know, that's pretty crude. And I was like, yeah, that's probably right. And then he's like, do you know anything about Kobe? I was like, no. And I started looking into it. Kobe and the work that he put into the dig deep, the work harder attitude, like everything about him, I really felt pretty crummy about making the one-off comment. I make a lot of comments for a lot of different reasons. I was making a comment on something I completely didn't know anything about, which I've stopped doing. If I don't know anything about that, like, what do you think? I'm like, well, I haven't done enough research to have an opinion on that. I really don't know. And they're like, really? I'm like, yeah, I can't say.
My new favorite phrase, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
That's so important.
Well, I want to ask you, what does IDK stand for?
I don't know.
Neither does anybody else.
But no, I don't know keeps the conversation going.
It does. It really does.
I got family members. I got friends who know everything about everything.
Oh, yeah.
I got to tell you, somebody will ask me, hey, do you know about this? And I could pretend just to kind of get you to shut up. But I don't want to. I want to know what that is. I don't know what that is. Maybe I should know what that is. So to me, that's part of keeping an open mind and also vulnerable. You know, I want to be vulnerable. I want you to know, like when I'm in a meeting with a client, they'll bring up something. I'm not one of these auctioneers who knows everything and you don't, because I know a lot of those. They'll go, do you know how to do this? And I go, wow, what is that? A paddle drop. I just learned what a paddle drop is the other day from another auctioneer. It's been around for a long time and I had no idea what it was. So we talked through how to do it. It's where at the end of an event, everybody who wants to give $50 or $100 turns in their paddles. And then we bring all the paddles up on stage and we say, we're going to throw them up in the air. And the one that we catch wins this prize, you know, like a trip or a wine basket or something. And I had never heard of that. So now I'm like, oh, okay. Let me think how I want to put that into my show or how we can make that a moneymaker, you know, and change that around. Yeah. If I had said, oh yeah, I know all about it and not, man, I just lost an idea. I could have lost an idea there that could have changed. Could have helped my clients, I guess.
I am under the impression that I don't know everything. I have opinions about things, but I want to hear your opinion because I want to find out how you got there. Am I missing out on an experience? Is there something that you read that I didn't read? Like, why is it that we have a different opinion? What do I get to learn today? It's so vital to who I am just to have this really questioning attitude. What's this, that, and the other? I remember sitting in a class, a military class, notorious for acronyms. And they rattled off like three in one sentence. Hand goes up. Like, yeah, what's going on? It's like, what's this and that and the other one? And the whole class like looked at me. You don't know what this is? I'm like, no. And if it's vital to what's going on here and we need to use that stuff 3 minutes from now, and I don't know what the heck we're talking about, like, it's not going to work for me. So I had to like forcibly stop the class to get them to spell out acronyms and talk because I just wasn't familiar with that part of the Navy. I had been in the strategic world, the nuclear command and control world, not the surface, the fleet, the ship, Navy. I was never in that world. So someone in my position with my many years and should have that experience, I was just never in that part of the Navy. They were all staring at me. I was like, I'm responsible for this information once this class is over. And if I don't learn it now, I ain't going to have time to learn it later. So now is the time. And they're like, they eventually, calmed down a little bit, but like, you don't know? No, and I don't feel bad for not knowing.
That's the key. You don't feel bad for not knowing. When we were kids in school, and if I didn't know something, I was too afraid because people in the class would laugh at you or you don't know how the reaction's going to be.
They make you feel bad for not knowing. Yeah.
But as adults, I think it's easier to say, I don't know. And people get it. You know, if I'm in a room and I can tell, I can even read if somebody doesn't know what I just said. Oh, here's what it means. Mm-hmm. And that's an education part. I think that's important. I wish you'd teach a class or go on tour to teach people to think the way you think about learning from others' opinions. Seems like we could use that in the world right now a lot.
I'm actually building out a speech to talk about exactly that topic. I'm hosting another show. We haven't launched it yet. It's called the Titan Evolution Podcast. We bring on titans in their industry, showcase the stuff that they've done that's amazing, that everyone agrees upon. All right, now what did it take to get here? What did you have to overcome? What did you have to go through? Did you have to be like Rocky and jog through the snow in Siberia to, get up to fight the Russian or whatever it was? Like, what did you have to do to get, like, what did it actually take? You know, how many days a week did Michael Phelps have to swim and do all this craziness in order to be able to compete for that many medals and that many gold medals, most in history? Like, what did it take to get there? That's the story. That's what I want to hear. And then what advice do you have to do it? So we interviewed a guy. Lou Marinoff, he's a professor of a city university in Harlem. It's got the most Nobel laureates coming out of that school of all time. And the thing that he talked about, he's the first interview. He's very knowledgeable. He's a little long in the tooth. So some of his answers are pretty robust, but he talked about offense and being offended. And he talked about why he won Teacher of the Year and how that worked. And it's because he allowed the class to question things, to ask questions. He's a philosophy professor. It's very important to be able to ask questions and have that discourse, because if you can't have it in college in a safe environment, good Lord, where can you have it? And the kind of the precipice, the focus of the talk was that I can't offend you. I can say something, but I can't offend you. You actually have to take it. You have to take offense. It's not like the particles flying out of my mouth are inherently offensive, right? There's no special sadness that travels on the sound waves. And when it hits you, you're automatically sad or offended or anything. Like, you determine how you feel when you hear that thing. And the only way you can get offended is actually if you take offense. You have to decide to take it. Yeah.
He put it in a much more eloquent way than I've always felt that. Like, my wife will sometimes go, don't judge me. And I go, You're the one deciding you're being judged, not me. I'm not judging you. So when people say you're offending me, and I'm like, well, no. I'm trying not to, but B, that's on you. You're the one deciding to be that way. In my job, up on stage, I need to be everybody's best friend. I need to be apolitical. I'm Switzerland. I am non-blue material. I mean, nothing negative on stage. My job is for everyone, no matter how they think, political, anything about them, we're here for the nonprofit. We're here to give. And I have to be that lightning rod. And so that has taught me, my opinion is just not important. It's not as important as I once thought it was.
You're the entertainer in the thing. And I know we're getting off track here a little bit. We're going to get back on track here, folks. Like, I remember Reba McEntire being a guest. I think she was on The View, and they asked about, they were talking about entertainers stopping their shows and then talking about a social issue or a political topic. And she's like, I've never done that. And she's like, I feel like when people come to my events, they're there to get away from the world and unplug, to be entertained, to just be in a place. And she's like, I don't feel like on stage is my, I don't think that's my right to stop everything and give my opinion on a situation, especially when I don't really know all the facts. I can know some things, and there's things that can irritate me, but she's like, that's not why they're there. They're not here for my political stance on whatever. They're here because they want to have fun, unwind, unplug, be entertained. And she's like, I don't feel like that's my job to do.
That's has taught me just a huge lesson, mm-hmm. because I am there to represent, and I'm here to help and do the best I can. Nobody wants to hear my opinion. Not really. My own wife, I don't want to hear my own opinion. You know, it's just, I'm here to do good, and that's it.
Yeah. And most people just want their opinions reinforced anyway. They don't actually want to hear your opinion. They just want theirs confirmed.
True.
Yeah. But we're getting away from the opinions, back onto the auctioneer stuff. The golden ticket, the thing I've been wanting to ask you about, because I had never heard of this until I cracked open your book. Tell us what the golden ticket is and how it works.
It's been around forever, right? It's a raffle. So a golden ticket now has, in my opinion, three forms, and they're always morphing. So it's a high-end raffle. So let's say statistically, and this is about right, 20-25% of that audience can afford the live auction. Those are big ticket items, right? So the golden ticket was invented, not by me, but it's been around forever, to be a raffle where anyone can afford it. It's usually about $100. So I can afford $100 to give to the nonprofit for a chance to win a really big item. So the way we did it for years was the winner gets to pick one of the live auction items before I sell them. So I would bring the person up who won, and I would say, okay, here's the list of items. You got this trip and this beach house or this dinner. Which one do you want? They tell me, and they take it home scot-free, other than the $100 that they donated, right? So it's done. And then I would sell everything else. So that we would do that for years. But it was dependent on how well or how good these items were in the live auction. Then COVID hit. Nobody's giving these items. So one company called HGAfundraising.com, they're a consignment company for trips. They did something really brilliant. They took five of their items, which are big ticket, like a Tuscany and a Cabo. And I think one was a case of wine, and then a bourbon trip and a golf trip, I think. And they took those five and they said to the nonprofit, here, you pay us $2,000, which is the reserve, and offer these items. We're going to put 2 to 3 year validation on them. So
expiration date, you got a couple of years to use it.
Expiration. So that way we didn't know when we're getting out of COVID. So they don't worry about using it in a year. You've got plenty of time to use it, right? The winner. And so you picked one of those, and that solved the problem of not having any items. Now coming out last year, it morphed again and into my new favorite way, which is one item. So it's not about you deciding, the donor deciding what they want. It's one item, but it's really high end. So I had a client that did this wonderfully. They got a consignment item that was a Mexico house with a full staff and a chef and all that. I believe the reserve was $6,000, which is a little higher than I would want you to normally do it. I like a $2,000. But they sold, and this is because of virtual, it was a live event, but they sold the golden ticket to everyone and their mother, even if you couldn't be there. You did not need to be present to win. They sold $22,000. So they netted $16,000 when it was all said and done. And there's only 250, 300 in the room, right? It was because now with the golden ticket, you can sell it to everybody. Mm-hmm. And that's what made the difference. So imagine making $16,000 off of one item. And it's part of the live. We consider it part of the live auction. But it is a huge winner because, A, it's only $100. Everybody can play. They feel like they're part of the live auction. And it's just a big success. But I've taken it one step further. Now I take that item, if it's consignment and if I can sell it multiple times, I sneak it back into the live auction because 99.9% of that audience lost the golden ticket. So we sneak it into it and go, hey, that Tuscany trip you didn't win, I've got one. So this happened the other night. We made, $10,000 in the golden ticket off Tuscany. And again, Tuscany's a big bucket list right now. I sold another 5 of them during the live auction at $8,000 a piece.
So it's $50,000 you made on just Tuscany alone.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's morphed, but the golden ticket is such an easy way. You don't have to go get a bunch of stuff for it. Consignment is a mixed bag. I'm a auctioneer who says consignment when you need it. There are some great companies out there, Mitch Stewart and Winspire and HGA and a bunch of others. It's when you need it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to say there are auctioneers who make a pretty good living just off residuals from selling these. I don't. I choose not to take that. So it's still legit, but I have to put my nonprofit's needs first. And what is it that they need? If they only need one consignment or none, fine. But this is a great way to use consignments because it's really hard for most nonprofits to get an exotic type of trip this way.
Oh, that makes sense. That definitely makes sense. So I got one more thing I want to ask you before we wrap up. For those people that are trying to put together an event, an auction or whatever, what is the preferred order of events? What's the best way to order all the different events within a gala? And you've got a couple of hours to do it. How do you want to stack those? Do you want to do like the awards and speeches first? Do you want to hold those off to the end? What does that look like?
So it depends on, and I won't get too technical, right? There's a couple of templates because I have hands-on with run a show with a client. So it depends. Is it a sit-down dinner? That's the first thing I ask. Or is it food stations, right? Because we're going to be a little different on how we run. However, for the most part, it is a welcome, maybe an award in there. The welcome is 5-6 minutes, whatever we can pack in there. Thank yous, maybe an award. Into the fund a need first. That was never the way until about 5 or 6 years ago. It was always live auction first. I'm all about fund a need first. I was one of the few auctioneers who still, and there's still a bunch of auctioneers who won't do it. For the most part, fund a need first because it's the emotional part of the night. It is the serious part and it's the biggest moneymaker as we talked about before. Then that segues into the live auction because the live auction is the fun. It's the frivolity, right? So if you put that first and then try to hit the brakes and go serious, very hard to do. So mm-hmm. It would go welcome, fund a need, live auction, raffle, or no, live auction. Then if you have more awards or a keynote speaker or any of that, after that. Because anything after the live auction, when we are done with the fundraising part, I don't care what you do. Because people, if they decide they're going to walk away, they've already given and bought. If you do all these speeches and all these awards and then get to the money making at the end of the night, I literally see people walking out, people who could have given out. So do it earlier is better.
So I imagine when you describe these in the book, the fund to need really applies to everyone. The live auction, there's a large portion of the audience that really just can't compete or is not willing to compete for some of this stuff. So having the fund to need first, when they can give early and often before the auction, that makes more sense.
Yeah. And I got to tell you, I'm doing more fund to need only events now than ever before. I think people are tired of stuff. Again, for my nonprofit, overworked, underpaid, very hard to go out and find things. Some of them get great things, but for the most part, it's very, very hard.
Yeah.
The fund to need is an easy setup. It's an easy thing to put together. And so, and people, by the way, I think just want to give. They want less stuff. I'm not discounting the silent. Yes, it still can make money. The live still can make money. It depends on your particular audience. And that's one of the first things I look at when I sit with an a client. Tell me about your audience. Let me see your data. What are they buying? Because I'm all about the data. Mm-hmm. And that will help us decide what we need to do.
Yeah, actually ask them, like, where do you want to go on your dream vacation? And then get that one created and have that one available, right?
Survey Monkey, give them what they want. You are dead on. And you should see my clients go, huh? And I go, or how about get on the phone and call your board or your top 10 givers last year and ask them what is it they want to buy? Don't guess. Don't guess. Man, let's just give them what they want.
We had a Get Motivating seminar came through Oklahoma. Shoot, must have been 9 or 10 years ago. And they had speakers come up, like all these fantastic, like Hillary Clinton and Colin Powell and Rudy Giuliani and Joe Montana and a couple other, you know, salespeople, right? They're getting all pumped up to sell you stuff. Someone came in and they had this big speech and you're going to earn lots of money so you could buy a Mercedes AMG. And the crowd was silent because we're in Oklahoma, right? We don't care about a Mercedes AMG. We're not West Coast, right? They didn't know the audience. And he's like, a new Ford F-150. And then the crowd erupted. So
yeah,
by virtue of not knowing your audience, you're going to end up trying to sell them something that they have no interest in, right?
Yeah. I mean, if you're a school, you are not going to take that Tuscany trip. If you're a pre-K, no, you're not leaving your children. However, a Disney trip is something they will fight for. So know your audience. Data, data, data. Data is the king because it tells me who's buying, what are they buying, what do they want, what percentage. And that's where mobile bidding apps are so great, you know, like GiveSmart and OneCause and all that. They tell the true story and then build it around that. It's mm-hmm. that it's pretty it's simple, but it's hard.
You cracked me up because you said people will fight over the Disney stuff. I just immediately pictured like two moms going at it, fist fighting. That's immediately what popped into my head.
Man, I was like, I'm so happy to say I've never seen that. I've had people.
Mom's got like a busted eye and blood running out because I'm taking my kids to Disney. Get out of here with it. Like that's immediately where I went. So I've had a rougher life than some people, I think.
You hear behind the scenes. I got to tell you, I have a chair come in and go, I'm going to bid on that. She'll say it out to the air to me or somebody. Nobody's buying that from under me. And I'm that's the attitude I love, you know, but I've never seen real fights. Thank God, nothing like that. I've had two men faint at two different auctions. One right before the fund to need by the bar. I mean, we were about to ask for the money and he fainted. Now both guys ended up fine, but EMT had to come in. Right. And it stops the show and the fundraising went. However, the second guy was about 6'5", fell straight back on a concrete floor. And we thought, oh my God, he's dead. He sat up while we're waiting for EMT and said, please continue. And we went on and did great. He was fine because the audience could breathe. There was a sigh of relief.
Well, perspective matters, right? That jovial nature that some people have, like, don't let your circumstances affect that. Heard a story about a guy, fell out, great guy. Everyone loved him. Like you see that guy coming out of the street, you're like, oh man, I can't wait to talk to this guy. Like just so energetic and right. He was doing a construction job, fell out of a third story and they got him in the ambulance. They were taking him away. He was awake kind of barely. And they asked him like, hey, before we get started, like, is there anything that you're allergic to? And he pulled off the oxygen mask and he's like, apparently gravity. Right. And the And every, you know, the room erupted and then they were able to relax and go and do the surgery and stuff that they needed. He was fine and everything recovered. But like that sense of, you know, knowing who you are and not changing just because of a circumstance is such a fantastic way. Dean, where can people get a hold of you? Where is the one place you want them to go?
Well, I want them to get the book. So I'm going to give a free PDF to anybody listening. Nonprofits, please go get it right now. PaddlesUpBook.com. Paddles with an S, UpBook.com. If you need a hard copy, you can go to Amazon. It's there cheap. But I'd rather just give it to the nonprofits that need it. You can reach me through there or MyBenefitAuctioneer.com. MyBenefitAuctioneer.com. And I do a consult. I do a free 30-minute consult. And let's see if we're fit, if you need my services.
Yeah, please do that. PaddlesUpBook.com. Get the free PDF. Dean was gracious enough to send me a couple of copies of these. So if you're in Oklahoma City, you can swing by and borrow a copy. It's like 60 pages. Big font for the older audience. Real quick read. I read it this morning. No problem. Very straightforward. None of that nonsense and fluff and flowery stuff. It's like, this is what it is. This is what we do. You go bam, bam, bam. And because you don't got time to read all these books. I'm retired. I can read as much as I want. You guys are in the fight. You guys are working hard. You guys need to get this. PaddlesUpBook.com. Read it quickly. Thanks again, Dean, for being my guest today.
Thank you so much. What a great conversation, man. This was this is really fun. Yeah. So if I had a podcast, I'd bring you on it. But if not, I'll just call you and we'll just start talking. I'll tell you I'm recording it if that makes you feel better.
This call may be recorded for quality assurance.
You've been listening to The Nonprofit Architect. To listen to all our past shows, visit http://nonprofitarchitect.org. And be sure to subscribe, rate, and review our show. Thank you.